Today's Teisho will be on case 43 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 43, Shuzan's Shippe. Shuzan Osho held up a shippe before his disciples and said, "You monks, if you call this a shippe, you oppose its reality. If you do not call it a shippe, you ignore the fact. Now tell me, you monks, what will you call it?" Mumon's comment, if you call it a shippe, you oppose its reality. If you do not call it a shippe, you ignore the fact. Words are not available. Silence is not available. Now tell me, what is it? Mumon's verse, holding up the shippe, he gives life, he takes life. Opposing and ignoring interweave. Even Buddhas and patriarchs beg for their lives. I want to thank everybody for coming this morning to practice Zen. This beautiful practice. I hope you had a very good sit this morning. So this is a famous koan. I should explain, first of all, what a shippe is. It would help, I guess. Sometimes this is just translated as Shuzan's stick. And so it's sometimes said that Shuzan held up a stick and said, "What is this? What is this?" But actually, the proper translation is Shuzan's shippe. In Zen tradition, there are a number of different ritual objects. One of them is called a keisaku, or a kyosaku. And it's a long stick, about a yard in length. And it's at the bottom, at the base of the stick, it's round, like a tennis racket, only not as thick. And then it's designed so that it tapers as it's roundish at the base, and a little bit like a tennis racket handle, like the handle of a tennis racket. And then it tapers toward the as it goes upward, and it becomes flat and paddle-like toward, say, the top half or the top third is flat and paddle-like. This is sometimes called the keisaku, and it's sometimes called the kyosaku. In Chinese, this was known as an incense board. It perhaps was called an incense board because it was placed right in front of the incense bowl. So in a traditional Chan temple, or traditional Zen temple, there would be a stick up here at the front of the room. Traditionally, what would happen is that after the sit had begun, after the bells were rung, an officer of the Zendo would get up. Often this person in Japanese is called the Jikijitsu, would get up and patrol the Zendo. This goes back to Chinese times also. The idea is that somebody gets up and takes the keisaku and goes up and down the aisles. And this is in traditional Zen practice, happens almost every sit. So this is like, a little bit like a drill sergeant inspecting the troops, you know. So the person who has the stick will start walking down the aisle, looking to make sure everybody's posture is correct, and straightening people up if they're not sitting properly, and heaven help you if you move. because the tradition is the person will hit you with the stick. And there's a ritual. The person doesn't just hit you, but you have to lean forward and put your palm on the ground, and your other arm is lower than one shoulder's higher than the other. And the person hits the meaty part of your back with the stick, and I think it's three hits in the summer and four hits in the winter. In a traditional Zen setting, this person will be starting out the sit and looking, and it's a little nerve-wracking, right? Somebody's staring at you. That in itself is enough to make you nervous. And also, if somebody's staring at you and you're telling yourself, don't move, it's very likely you're going to move, So you're sitting there, the person's coming, going, here and coming. You're thinking, don't move, and all of a sudden you have this irresistible desire, right, to move your shoulder or something. And if you do that, the person's going to, you hear that, you get the tap, you get tapped with the stick, and then you have to lean forward and then, and then they do the other side. So do one side of your back, and the person has to be well trained or could potentially injure you. You don't want to hit the scapula, that you want to hit the big muscles in the back. And people who are scrawny, having done this, it's difficult to do it in the appropriate way. The idea isn't to hurt the person, and I've been hit many times, and there's no bruises. If it's done properly, it's just kind of a shocker. My feeling is that this is not necessary, and so we've gotten rid of it. People sit very well in our group without being yelled at or hit with a stick or intimidated or threatened in any way. And even though it is designed to be a compassionate stimulus for practice, I think it's probably counterproductive in a setting like ours. And so we don't have the keisaku, but it's a sort of a symbol almost of Zen. And there's another symbol of Zen too, which is called a shippe. And a shippe is smaller than the keisaku, and it's like a little baby keisaku. It's about a third of the size or half the size, and often the teacher is holding it in Dokusan. So in a traditional Zen temple, sometimes you go into Dokusan, and even if the teacher wants to express something, he'll use the shippe. So you could go into Dokusan, and all of a sudden you get the with the shippe, And sometimes the teacher will even hit you when you give him a good answer, because he's pleased. Again, we don't have a shippe, but it can be a. Sometimes they're made out of bamboo also. And Genki Roshi had one that really looked, you would hate to be hit by it. It was like the base of a bamboo, a big bamboo plant. It was varnish or something, and I don't know what that was doing in there, and I didn't want to know. I didn't even want to look at it. It made me nervous. But I think it was just for show. But sometimes Genki Roshi had his shippe in the Dokusan room. Shippe is a ritual staff, you could say, this ritual board. It's used in a traditional teaching setting. In the context of this koan, it means something more than that. I mean, or maybe I shouldn't put it that way. The teacher walks into the main hall during Teisho and holds up his shippe and says, "What is this? See, what is this?" This is like a classic Zen question. And the koan is really very clever because it gives you it blows a lot of smoke in your eyes. It gives you a lot of confusing false signals. So the koan actually goes like this: If you call it a shippe, you oppose its reality. If you do not call it a shippe, you ignore the fact. See, so it says, "What is this?" And if you call it a shippei, you ignore, you oppose its, what does it say? If you call it a shippei, you oppose its reality. In other words, if you assign a name to it, you're not capturing the essence of the stick. Right? If you give it a name, you're not capturing its essence. But if you say it's not a shippei, you're opposing the fact. Right? So this is the way this koan is phrased is really very good, because you sit down on the cushion and you think, okay, I've been hit by the shippei. I know what it is. But if I say it's a shippei, I've missed the essence of it, because I'm just using a word, see? But if I say it's not a shippei, then I'm denying its reality. So what do I do? You know, if I call it a shippei, I'm not there. If I say it's not a shippei, I'm not there. And by the way, if you go in silence, also that would be a bad answer too. So this is really like a wonderful koan. If you know anything about how koans work, if you've been practicing for a while, you know that the proper way to work with a koan is not to try to figure it out. So if you're sitting on the cushion and you're trying to work through the answer intellectually, you haven't really engaged with the koan yet. And it's quite typical sometimes for people when they're first given a koan, especially a koan like this, to sit there and try to figure it out. So, you know, you might try to think of a good answer to this koan. Another koan that works like this is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? See, and I sometimes use that when I give talks on Zen, and somebody will always come up to me later and show me their hand. They'll clap with one hand by slapping their fingers on their palm, right? And they figured that out during the talk, right? But that's not the answer, you know. So that's an intellectual, that's an attempt to figure it out intellectually, like it's a trick question. You know? So you could spend a lot of time trying to work through this philosophically, especially if you've read a lot of books on Zen. And you might have a whole philosophy that you could bring to bear on this question. But the proper way to work with a koan is at some point to give up on trying to figure it out, and then to sit down on the cushion and work, watch your breath or call mu, until your mind becomes, you have little intervals where your mind becomes a blank and dark. Yeah. And basically you start repeating the koan. And this is like a subliminal cue or a psychological cue. So in this case, you would be in deep concentration, and you would be entering mu xin, which is a state of thoughtless attentiveness. Occasionally, you'd be able to enter that state for periods that are, from a couple seconds to maybe a minute or so, and you might be able to repeat that quite frequently during any particular half hour. And while you're in that state, you want to just keep repeating like a mantra. In this case, you would repeat you'd say, what is it? What is it? What is it? And of course, often as you're saying that, you might have the image of the shippei in front of you, right? You'd be thinking about that stick. It could be a keisaku, it could be an orange. Any object will do, you know. And you just keep working with that. This can take a long time, you know, this process of working through the koan. And it's largely an unconscious process. So when you're working with a koan, for almost the whole time you're working with a koan, you may have no sense of making any progress whatsoever. So when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath or you're calling Mu and you're saying, what is it? You know, day after day, you just come in and do that, and various things may arise in your mind. You know, as you're sitting there, you might remember your dog, you know, and you might go into Dokusan and say, it's my dog. You know, that would be a possible answer. Or, you know, who knows what might come up. But you just keep going back to that blank mind, to that zero point. And for a long time, you might be having answers or giving answers without much conviction. And you might think, oh, I'm getting nowhere with this koan. I've been working with this koan for months, and I'm not getting anywhere. So this is quite common, because when you're trying to assess your performance, you use your conscious discriminating mind. And so we call that the little mind in Zen. The conscious discriminating mind is looking at your performance and trying to find clues or of progress, you know, trying to find some indication of progress. When I have to write something, you know, I try to do a couple, if I have a good day when I'm writing, I might do 4 pages. And usually it's not that good of a day, but a good day I might do 4 decent pages. You know, after I've been working on something for a while, I might have 20 pages. And I might say, well, I'm making progress, you know, because I used to have no pages and now I have 20 pages. That's my discriminating mind, my small mind, making a decision on the basis of certain kind of evidence, you know. But when you're working with a koan, your little mind keeps looking for signs that your pages are adding up, or but there's no sign of this, because the processing is all unconscious. And eventually, you'll have some kind of a breakthrough, some kind of an insight, or some kind of a compulsion, which is the answer. It's a little bit like, you know, you've probably seen those, or maybe you haven't, but there used to be books called, there were puzzles called Where's Waldo? And it was a puzzle, a picture, and it had many elements to it. It might be a picture of like a forest. And there would be birds and different kinds of leaves in the trees, and maybe some fruit in the trees, and a running stream. And somewhere in all of this, these line drawings, there would be a picture of Waldo. And Waldo was shown, so you could see Waldo and then look for him in the picture. And somewhere hidden in all of these forms was Waldo. Basically, you know, you can look at this picture for a long time and not find Waldo. You're looking and you're looking and you're looking, and all of a sudden, oh, he pops out, and it seems so obvious at that moment. My God, there it is, right there. You know, that kind of a process is very much like working with koan. You know, you're looking and you're looking and you're looking at the koan, and you keep seeing nothing. And if you listen to your discriminating mind, you'll have a miserable experience, right? Because your discriminating mind is always saying, well, it's got to be here somewhere, you know. And then the discriminating mind says, oh, I knew I'd never be any good at this, and I'm a loathsome person, I'm an idiot, I'll never wake up, I'm another year older, and I'm still not enlightened, blah, 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 you know. Or you might think, this is a bunch of crap, this is a scam, you know, whatever. And the little mind the little mind can't find Waldo. You know, you need to let the mind sort of float freely in a kind of attentive but unfocused state to find Waldo, right? If you're looking too hard, you'll never find Waldo. You sort of let your mind play over all these images in a kind of not focused but attentive state. And there's a kind of unconscious recognition process that goes on in finding Waldo. This is very, I think this is quite accurate, you know. You can't fine-tune it too much. You have to give the unconscious some room to do its work. And eventually, you can get very good at this. You can get very fast at finding Waldo, you know. And a koan training is like this too. You're learning how to let a big mind, the unconscious mind, operate dynamically. See? This is like a different kind of intelligence. It's not the kind of intelligence that feels sharp and precise, like when you're doing math problems, or you're working through a problem in science, or you're reading philosophy, you know. It's a different kind of intelligence. It's more associative, and it's actually more holistic, you know, really, more connective thinking. And this kind of intelligence can be cultivated. We have you might have seen, we have a new Buddha statue that Kriti and Imtiaz brought from India. And in this Buddha's hand, he holds a Vajra. This is really not from Zen, this is really from late Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, but it's a beautiful statue, and it doesn't have to be from Zen. Right? The Vajra is really can be translated as diamond, but it also can be translated as a lightning bolt or thunderbolt, and indeed, what the Buddha is holding in his hand is a stylized. Like a lightning bolt. When we do lightning bolts, we have a jagged line. But their lightning bolts are very beautiful, and I can't really describe them, but they're symmetrical. They almost look like an hourglass, but a little bit like an hourglass. There's two spheres that they're like spheres, teardrop shapes. Joined at the center, quite beautiful. And the Vajra represents this kind of intelligence, see, which is not the discriminating intellect. It's the kind of intelligence that finds Waldo in the midst of all this complexity. Yeah? So it's very, it's a very good Buddha for our practice, because it's, the Vajra is this other intelligence. It symbolizes this other intelligence. It's the intelligence that finds the pattern in all the complexity. See, this is quite this. We have this. The discriminating mind it dominates modern life. We really live by the discriminating mind, and discrimination means to separate this from that. Another word for it would be analytical mind, right? And language itself does this, you know, actually. So basically, the function of words is to divide up the world into standardized packages, right? I mean, we need them. I'm using them right now. But they have their limits, because words separate, you know. When I was much younger, I used to love to hike when I was in college. I used to love to hike, but I knew nothing about trees. So I would go out and hike, and I would see all these green conifers, you know, trees with needles. And I would always call them pines. You know, I would say, oh yeah, I was up in the pines. It was so beautiful. Now, many years later, I got interested in gardening and trees. And my wife bought me a book on trees. And it turns out that what I was calling pines, those weren't pines at all. They were spruces or hemlocks. So now when I go into a forest, I don't see quote unquote pines. I see hemlock, spruce, fir. See, this is the function of language. Now, you get a certain gain in precision, right? But you start making discriminations or distinctions. And the function of a distinction is to isolate the object of your attention, you know? So before, I was just like this green stuff out there. You know, I like this green stuff, you know? Very beautiful. Or trees, say trees. Now that I have studied trees, I can see this is a red oak. There's a difference, you know, there's a red oak, there's a scarlet oak, and there's a white oak. And don't be deceived, they're quite different, right? In front of the dormitories on College Avenue, the river dorms, those are white oaks. They have round lobes and broad habit, as we say, in the world of trees. So they don't grow tall, they grow wide. See, and they're very beautiful. Sometimes you'll see trees that aren't wide like that. They're tall oak trees, and they have pointy lobes. Their leaves are pointy. Those are probably like a scarlet. If it's a big leaf, it's a scarlet oak. But if it's a little skinny leaf, it might be a pin oak, like Pinocchio. See, Pinocchio's a joke on pin oak, right? Once you know trees, it's hard to appreciate trees. Once you know different species of tree, different varieties different varieties, it's hard to appreciate them the way I used to appreciate them, right? I used to just have this non-differentiated appreciation for this green stuff. And now, if I want to, I can see spruce, I can see pine, and I can, if somebody says, those are pines, I go, oh, no, you know, those are not pines, my good fellow, you know, those are spruces. And you know how I can tell, you know, and a fir would have a flat needle, and a spruce has a round needle, you know, so don't, okay. So discriminating mind is really good at making certain kinds of distinctions, but you know, the dominant mood of the modern world is the discriminating mind, to use the discriminating mind. And we have used it and used it and used it, you know. And we have created like marvels with our discriminating intellects. You know, we have the power to create these incredibly complicated cities and so on and so on. So, you know, of course it's very valuable to have this kind of intelligence and you know, if you are going for your degrees in something or, you know, you have a special skill, you know, that's wonderful. And I'm not criticizing discriminating intellect. But it is possible to become very unbalanced, you know. So I think modern people are quite unbalanced in their appreciation or their approach to the world, because no matter what the problem, no matter what the issue, they always approach things, or very often approach things, from the standpoint of the analytical or discriminating mind. And the result is a very fragmented world. It's a world of individual objects, yeah? This is sort of like the modern world of that many people think they live in, you know. It's just there's a kind of object-centered world where you just say, well, there's just a world of things. You know, we live in a world of things, and those are the only things that are real. You know, so you know, there's sticks and stones and trees and cars and buildings, and that's real. And I can look at the stick and I can hold the stick, or I can look at the rock and I can hold the rock, and I can look at the car, you know, I can look at the building. And you're right, I mean, those objects are real. But, you know, objects don't make a world, you know, actually. We're so used to using the discriminating mind that we don't appreciate that the world becomes like a living world when all of these objects fit together somehow. See, the world isn't just like a collection of objects. it fits together somehow. It's like a living whole, right? I mean, we know this kind of intellectually. You can't have human beings without oxygen. You can't have oxygen without trees and bacteria. You can't have trees and bacteria without birds. You know, you can't have birds without, on and on, you know. So we know intellectually with our discriminating minds that things, that the world isn't just like a collection of objects. It all has to fit together somehow. But, you know, in the modern world, we don't really have a powerful intelligence for appreciating that the way things fit together, you know, and we are so obsessed with the things in themselves, we're not aware of like the connector, the connections, you know. I hope this is making some sense, because what we're doing on the cushion, one way of understanding what we're doing on the cushion, is that we're cultivating the kind of intelligence that becomes aware of things not in their isolation, but in their connectedness to everything else, you know? And this sounds very philosophical, you know, this sounds like philosophy, and therefore that's too bad, you know, from a Zen standpoint. But you can experience it yourself. When we sit down on the cushion, if you just watch your breath very carefully, some interesting things might begin to happen to you after a while. Probably not the first time you do it, but if you straighten your back and you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, you might have a lot of sits where your mind is just buzzing with thoughts and everything. But, you know, one day you might be sitting on the cushion, and if you're not in this room, we're sort of isolated, but if we're in some other place, maybe you're sitting at home or it's at Sesshin, and you're sitting and you're watching your breath and you're watching your breath, and all of a sudden you hear like the wind blow, or you hear a bird cry, you know, and it's just deeply moving, you know, it's deeply moving. This is like an experience of your connectedness to things. You know, sometimes it almost feels like the sound of the bird or the sound of the wind is coming out of your own body. And this actually happens to people on the cushion. You know, it's like you feel a totally unified with this wind or this bird sound. And you might think, well, that's the darndest thing. You know, that's a strange thing. You can go back to your breath. But what's happening is that you're experiencing things in their connectedness. See, this is so important, because it's easier for, I think it's easy for people to see objects in their isolation. That maybe we tend, you know, maybe our neurological wiring pushes us in that direction anyway. I don't know. Maybe not. But that seems to be so easy. It's one of the reasons it's so easy for people to be selfish, right? You know, we tend to look at the isolated thing. You know, we tend to look at ourselves, and we don't think about how we connect to everybody else, you know? My brother was a nice guy in a lot of ways, but he had one terrible defect, and that was that he was a Republican. Just kidding, of course. And my brother was a very hardworking guy. He studied. His interest was biology, but he eventually went to work in business. And went through a complete transformation, because he had been like a hippie, you know. He was like this nature-loving hippie. And then, for some reason, probably personal crisis in his life, he went through like a total transformation. He cut his hair, and he started working for a business, and he would go to work in a suit, you know, and he started reading the Wall Street Journal. I was like, my God, what's happening to my brother, you know? And he really became deeply committed to that worldview. And I loved my brother, and we never talked about this, but I mean, my brother used to say, you know, my brother had a challenging life because he owned his own business, and he did build it up. He started with nothing, with no money, and he wound up owning quite a successful business, and he had employees, and he worried all the time. He'd lie in bed and worry because his business might fail, and he had a lot of stress. And my brother used to say, you know, he'd say things like, "Nobody helped me. I did it all myself," you know? And I loved my brother, and I realized that if I was going to have a relationship with my brother, I couldn't get into this with him, or at least I thought that was the case. So I would just let it go, and my brother liked to hunt, and my wife was always eager to have a big argument with my brother over hunting, you know? And I used to say, let it go, you know, because I don't want to lose all contact with my brother, you know? So I was worried that if we pushed him too far, he tended to be a rather withdrawn person in some ways anyway. So I was afraid I'd lose touch with him altogether, and I didn't want to do that. But, you know, when he'd sit there and say, "I did it all myself," I would think to my, you know, think of all the times some teacher helped my brother, you know, in school. Or I think of all the times my mother, you know, took time out to do something special for my brother, you know, so many times. I think of Dr. DeBoard, our family physician, who used to make house calls to our house when we were sick. Dr. DeBoard was just this great doctor. My brother had some health problems when he was young. My brother had a speech impediment when he was young. He couldn't pronounce his R's. So our next door neighbor was Mr. Morrissey, and my brother would say, "Mr. Morrissey," right? And he had to go to speech class, and he was humiliated, but some teacher taught him to say, "Mr. Morrissey," right? But all of this is forgotten, right? We're at the breakfast table, and we have the Wall Street Journal, and we say, "I did it all myself." Right? But I'm not making fun of my brother. We all do that, right? Because there's a part of our minds which is just very easily lulled into this separateness, you know? And yet, you know, my brother didn't do it all himself. He didn't. You know, he worked hard, I have to admit. You know, he wasn't a freeloader and so on. But it was harder for him, I think, to see the connectedness. And, you know, sometimes people come to Sesshin and they don't think, "Hey, I'm experiencing connectedness," you know? It isn't like that, because it's not a process that involves the discriminating mind that uses language. But, you know, one of the things that happens to people sometimes is by day three, you know, you're not using words anymore so much, you know? You walk into the dining room and you sit down at your place and there's a bowl of rice, but you don't think, "Rice again?" You know, you may not even think rice. You just stare blankly at this white stuff in a bowl, right? And then you hear a bird or something, or, you know, you smell the dal and you salivate, you know. That's like around day three, the mind becomes, it's like a different kind of intelligence begins to operate. And you don't think, "Oh, I'm more connected," you know, but you just think, "Man, this doll is really good," right? Because you are more connected. Yeah? And then, you know, around day four or five, strange things happen to people. One time, somebody came into the Dokusan room, and basically he said something like this. This is a sort of a version of what happened. Came in and he started crying. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, I realize that I am so mean to my dog sometimes. See, I think that's the most beautiful thing. Right? And the tears are running down his face. He said, I am so ashamed. I have been so mean to that dog. See, now, when those events happen, I feel like this is like a miracle, right? This is like so beautiful. This is why I think Zazen is like the for me personally, the highest thing, you know. Because this is like, yes, you know, that dog is your true self, you know. And you know, to we come home and we think, oh, it's just a dog, right? It's isolated, right? Mindset. He's a dog and I'm a person, right? And we're separate, you know. And he eats dog food and I eat human food, and so on and so on, right? Homo sapien, canine, whatever, canine Americanus or something. So that's what the discriminating mind says, but it's a lie. And so people sit in Zazen for 5 days and they come in and they're crying because of their dog. And they say, I'm so mean to my dog. I'm so sorry. Or they'll come in and say, this session is over, I'm going to call my brother and tell him that I love him. You know? This is like a miracle. Right? This is like, oh! You know, this is it. You know, everything is one life. But the discriminating mind can't experience that. It can't. You can write it, you can think it, but you aren't living it. You don't feel it, you know. In fact, writing it just reinstates a kind of isolation. Now, we need the discriminating mind, it's true, but modern mind is so unbalanced, right? This is why, by the way, it's so obvious, isn't it? This is why we don't do anything about the environment. You know, we don't. Because our baseline intelligence is so alienated and isolated. You know, people who have been to Sesshin for 5 days, you know, come back from walking in the woods and put a pine cone on the table next to their bed and get up every day and just smell the pine cone, right? And this beautiful experience comes over them, right? You know, beautiful state of joy, you know. And people walk in the woods and just feel like they're in heaven. Yeah. So this is the mind that experiences the one life aspect of our existence, and we know intellectually it is one life, right? If you use the discriminating intellect too much, you just go crazy. And really, modern life is really crazy. Someday, if life survives, if humans survive long enough, they're going to just be astounded at the way we behave. You know, yesterday, the Tata company announced that it has produced, and it was in all the papers, and they were all celebrating this, you know, and all the American car companies were crying because they had been beaten to the punch. But the Tata Motor Company in India has come out with a $2,500 car, and it's cute, you have to admit, you know, it's beautifully designed. It means that millions of people who now are forced to ride bicycles or walk are going to take these polluting these polluting vehicles, right? And so it's the stupidest thing in the world from a certain standpoint, right? We create these structures of thought that don't see the connectedness, right? Somebody is so happy today because he's going to sell millions of these cars. And the mind we use just can't, it's very hard for us to see the connectedness, right? It's But this is why I think Zen is so important, because even telling people, you know, when I was driving over here this morning, I was listening to the radio program Living on Earth, which is one of my favorite radio programs, and it's about ecology and everything. And I often listen to it when I'm driving around New Jersey, you know, for these Zen sits. But they were interviewing a father and his son, and this son said, you know, my daddy said that the polar bears are in trouble, and so on and so on. But you know, even with those messages, that kid will he'll just grow up to, you know, he won't notice, he won't have the immediate experience of connectedness that people need desperately, you know. I really believe this, that, you know, if you sit long enough, you know, if you're in deep samadhi for a few days, you literally couldn't hurt a flea. I'm not kidding. The time will come when you literally, it's so obvious that everything is part of yourself. There was a famous Zen master named Soyen Shaku, who wanted to go to India. And he went to India, and he took a boat. There was some kind of river boat. This was quite a while ago, at the turn of the previous century. And he said that he decided to do Zazen out on the deck of the boat. And he said he went into deep samadhi, and all of these mosquitoes started biting him. And he said he just kept sitting all night long, and in the morning he got up and he said it looked like there were red berries on his arm, you know, mosquitoes, but he just gently, carefully brushed them off so he wouldn't kill them. And you think that's crazy, right? But it's not crazy, I think. But he was somebody who spent a lot of time in a deep, deep mushin, deep, empty mind. So, Shuzan Osho wants to see how connective his students are in the way they experience the world, right? So he holds up a stick and he says, if you say it's a stick, you're wrong. If you say it's not a stick, you're wrong. And of course, beginners go back and try to figure it out with their discriminating mind. But you have to experience the whole universe as your life to answer this koan, right? And this is what we're doing on the cushion. You know, we're using the big mind to experience our connectedness to everything, our one life mind. Yeah? And it's beautiful. What a beautiful way to live. So, you know, you can continue to be a business person, and you can study management and accounting, and there's nothing wrong with that. We need such people. We need scientists. We need artists. We need writers, journalists, lawyers. We need those people. And that intelligence can be tremendously liberating and helpful if we have the other intelligence too. And without it, all of those beautiful forms of intelligence can become terribly destructive, as they are, I think, in the modern world. But with that other intelligence, all of those forms of intelligence could be very destructive, but when we have this other intelligence, it turns them all into like, well, you know, often you'll see this is an image that goes back to ancient India, and it was transported to China, but you'll sometimes see statues of Canon, of Avalokiteshvara, Guanyin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, And Kuan Yin is represented as a woman holding a vase, which is turned over, and that's like boundless compassion. It's like a receptacle emptying compassion. But sometimes Kuan Yin is represented as this being with like a thousand arms. See, it's like a thousand arms. Each arm is holding something. And one arm might be holding a pen or a brush. In the West, it would be a pen. Another arm might be holding, it sounds ridiculous to say so, but a microscope. And another arm might be holding a law book. And another arm might be holding, you know, and so on and so on. But this is like the fully realized human being. Because all of these capacities that we have, all of these abilities, are put into the service of this intelligence which sees with the unified mind in accord with the way. All self-centered striving ceases. So everything becomes like a world-protecting action. And that's our path. What a beautiful path. Shuzhan Osho held up a shippe before his disciples and said, "You monks, if you call this a shippe, you oppose its reality. If you do not call it a shippe, you ignore the fact. Tell me, you monks, what will you call it?" Mumon's comment: if you call it a shippe, you oppose its reality. If you don't call it a shippe, you ignore the fact. Words are not available. Silence is not available. Now tell me, quickly, what is it? Mumon's verse: holding up the shippe, he gives life, he takes life. That he is everything. In this world, life arises and life goes away, right? So you have a self that has a birthday, 1953, and has a death day and is male or female, but you also have a self that has no birth and no death. That self gives life and takes life. That's the big mind self. Okay. Opposing and ignoring, opposition and opposing and ignoring interweave. Even Buddhas and patriarchs beg for their lives. That's of course meaning this is a highly this is a wonderful state, a wonderful way to live.